Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Atlanta Business Radio. Stone Payton here with you this morning. Today's episode brought to you in part by ARC, American Reprographics Corporation. If you print with it, print on it, or simply want it printed, head on over to arcinatlanta.com. Or better yet, reach out and ask to speak personally with Mindy Godwin. Tell her Stone sent you. Her line, 770-394-2465. You guys are in for a real treat this morning. We got doctors, we got former presidents, authors, entrepreneurs, we got a president and a CEO. We got the whole gang here. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast former president at a little brand some of you may recognize called Coca-Cola, and now author and entrepreneur, Mr. Carl Ware. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Stone. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm delighted to be here as a part of this program and to talk a little bit about my life and my book and some of the interesting things that I think I've been doing.
I bet it is a deep, rich story. No way we can cover it in the depth that we'd like to, but we would certainly like to get a little bit of a feel for your path. How did you land here? Can you give us a little bit of the backstory?
Yeah, sure. I started out on a sharecropper's farm in Noonan, Georgia, in rural Cuyahoga County, where I grew up with 11 siblings. We were sharecroppers. Wow. And we had a lovely mama and daddy and who raised us to do the right things, to be prepared, to do the hard work, and to have humility, and to they emphasized education, and they emphasized preparation and hard work, discipline, godliness. And so that was the foundation for what I did in my life as I went from there to Clark College, now Clark Atlanta University, where I got a civil rights education, not just a bachelor's degree, but having been in the presence of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who inspired me to go into politics. And I did get elected to Atlanta City Council and served as the first African-American president of the Atlanta City Council, working alongside the first African-American mayor, Maynard Jackson. And we found the city in 1974 that had many faults and many difficulties, one of which was the exclusion systematically of African-American and women from contractual bidding in the Atlanta airport. And we changed that and dispelled some myths about minority participation by requiring minority joint ventures at the $2 billion expansion Atlanta airport. And we not only did we dispel that myth, but we were able to create opportunities in the private sector for minority contractors and engineers and lawyers and people who really did a fantastic job of recreating and rebuilding the Atlanta airport to the extent that it is now the busiest airport in the world. We brought that project in well under budget, ahead of schedule, dispelling myths on Wall Street that we were going to tarnish the stellar financial performance of and bond rating of the city of Atlanta. We dispelled that myth because we not only did we create an opportunity for the airport expansion and minority participation, but Atlanta became the Olympic city as a result of many of the
Because of that foundation. Quick question for you. I can anticipate that you may have received a great deal of resistance from the traditional business community. Yeah. But I wonder if, at least initially, did you also get a little resistance from the African-American business community, or if not resistance, disbelief, or not really believing you're going to be able to pull this off?
Well, I tell you, they were the leaders in the African-American business community, Atlanta Business League, and organizations like that were squarely behind our legislation, encouraged us to level the economic playing field in Atlanta, because not only were we not participating in city and public contracts, obviously, there were no participation hardly in any of the private mm-hmm. sector developments. The Coca-Cola Company building that we know now on North Avenue was built with a joint venture between Herman Russell and Bob Holder, the Holder-Russell JV, and was modeled after the city's minority joint venture participation project. So we got the ball rolling in the private sector as well. Banks at the time did not have African-American branch managers or vice presidents or anybody serving on the boards of directors. So it spilled over into a whole new kind of economic equity and professional involvement. Atlanta became a city that was no longer a city of exclusion, but a city of inclusion when it comes to minority participation, women, and other minorities in the affairs of the city of Atlanta. Thank goodness Mayor Andrew Young carried on that tradition, as did Mayor Shirley Franklin. And now Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms is continuing that legacy. That kind of spirit, I didn't necessarily learn at Harvard, which I attended, and at Clark or at Pitt or any of those places. I learned those fundamental values from Dr. King and from my parents, and took that whole strategy to Coca-Cola, where we instilled a culture of diversity in the Coca-Cola Company.
All right, I got to back you up before we go there. I'm trying to envision a household of 12 kids. I have two, and they're grown now. What an incredibly organized structure environment your mother must have been capable of.
Well, my mama was she was the best at organizing, and she was frugal.
That's who ought to run Coca-Cola.
We grew our own food for one thing on the farm, and my parents took the sharecropping experience as an opportunity to control our own destiny. It was counterintuitive to the times when my parents chose to stay on the farm and to save enough money, all of us working together, to buy the first 50 acres of land that we farmed and owned that we still live on today. I still live on that same land.
Wow.
Actually, I went back and bought all of the contiguous properties, which is now close to 1,000 acres. And it is called the Ware Farms, and that's where I live. I drove up from Newnan, Georgia this morning.
Well, we're going to have a bow hunting conversation after the show, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, we are. It was fun, but it was counterintuitive for them to stay while other black families during the Jim Crow South were fleeing to the north. They decided to put our anchors down on the land that we eventually owned, and to raise our family there. And thank goodness we didn't go up to Ohio or to Detroit or to New York, where the Great Migration took place during that time, which was a very strong and probably the largest human migration in the United States history. Blacks fleeing the South from the violence and intimidation of the Jim Crow South. My father became the first African-American to vote in the 5th Congressional District since Reconstruction. That was just how much determination he had to raise us right and to do the right thing and to take advantage of the opportunity. He had to be escorted to the poll by then Sheriff Lamar Potts. In order for him to not be intimidated by the Klan. I remember growing up and walking to school 2.5 miles from our farmhouse to school. And it was a time, it was rough, it was hard, it was difficult. We would be walking on dirty dirt roads and muddy roads, and white kids would come by in their pristine school buses and throw rocks at us. So we had to run into the bushes to hide. I remember recall that the Klan tried to invade our home, and we stood our ground, and they left. So it was not just a sort of folklorish kind of thing. It was real. It was tough. It was intimidating. But despite the odds, I was able to overcome those odds, seemingly impossible odds, seize opportunity, and make a difference in the lives of others. And that is the one thing that our parents always taught us, that no matter how poor we may be, we all should always find something to give to others. And that theme drove me to become a philanthropist. My wife and I gave a third of our wealth to Clark Atlanta University to build what is now known as the Carl and Mary Ware Academic Center. It's a 60,000 square foot state-of-the-art teaching facility at Clark Atlanta University. It's called the Carl and Mary Ware Academic Center. And it's not so much about the money, which what is so gratifying is for me to walk down the streets of Atlanta or through the airports around the country and around the world, and people coming up to me and say, "You, Mr. Ware, aren't you? I studied in your building." That to me is the gift that keeps on giving. And to see thousands and thousands of young African-American students and professionals, many of whom have gone on to do great things, thanking us for our generosity. I learned that on the farm with my parents, giving back when they could raise enough food in the gardens and in the fields to feed ourselves. They took what was left and distributed it into the community. That was sort of poor folks philanthropy, if you will. And but, you know, I had a great opportunity at Coca-Cola Company, the world's greatest, most iconic, ubiquitous brand. I was hired to in the governmental relations arena, moved into marketing, and eventually got promoted to president of Coca-Cola Africa. I was based out of London for several years, and I ran the entire Coke business in part of the Middle East and throughout the continent of Africa, and was a part of the anti-apartheid movement. In my book, I tell the story of how I worked closely with Archbishop Desmond Tutu to structure the Coca-Cola Company's disinvestment strategy in South Africa. And 10 years later, having the privilege of meeting Nelson Mandela as the first American businessman that he invited to sit down with him to discuss re-entering South Africa. They became very close friends of mine. Archbishop Tutu, I visited with them last year with his wife Leah down in Hermanus, just outside of Cape Town. I lived in Cape Town for 8 years. And of those 22 years that I worked on the continent of Africa. And so the point here is that God gives you power to do good things. And in every chance and opportunity that I had when I was on my way up through the ranks at Coca-Cola to create a diverse culture in the Coca-Cola Company, to become the person who's initiated the first African-American-owned Coca-Cola bottler in the history of the United States, the Philadelphia Coca-Cola Bottling Company, which Black Enterprise Magazine and Fortune Magazine named as the fourth largest African-American-owned business in the country by dollar amount at that time. And to be a part of creating the first Black South African Coca-Cola bottler ownership during the apartheid era.
Okay, I got to ask you, to fully capitalize on this power, and you quickly and very liberally give God and your parents credit for that, did you have to find a way to either set anger aside, or did you find a way to, how, I just feel like I would be such an angry person if my home had been attacked by whatever color people dressed in, whatever goofy, I just think I would be such an angry young man.
You know, there's a saying that says that fear is what is created in the dark room. Fear is the image that is created in the dark room, if you know photography. And so my parents taught me never to fear, to be optimistic, to be thankful, to be humble, And but to be strong, strong in my beliefs, my convictions, and stand on principles. When I did all of the work I did for 26 or 7 years at Coca-Cola, I came back to Atlanta with a boss who really didn't embrace diversity at the top in the company. And so he restructured the Coca-Cola company and essentially had 7 white males reporting to him under that restructure rather than at least one, in my case, me, reporting directly to the CEO. And I simply told him, walked into his office after he called me in London. I was sitting in London with a group of business leaders in London discussing our business strategies for Europe and for Africa and Middle East, et cetera. And he called me and told me about his restructuring. I said, I can't live with that. And I'm going to get on the plane. I took the Concorde. I flew directly from London over to Atlanta and turned in my resignation and said that I can't sell this to our employees, to our customers, to our business system. This is wrong for the Coca-Cola company. His answer to me was, this is not about any of that. It's about me. I said, oh, I said, I thought it was about the company. I said, I can't. Next thing I knew, Wall Street Journal, front page, where resigned, senior executive of the Coca-Cola company leaves the company. 2-3 weeks later, the board of directors fired him. Not just for that reason, but a number of other bundles, whatever you want to call it, that he had done. Well, you know, the point here is that you stand on your principles. Accomplishments and achievements are more long-lasting when you don't have to sacrifice your principles in the process of winning.
Tell us more about this book. What prompted you to write it, and what prompted you to write it now?
Well, listen, this book started to get written back in 2003, and I wrote on it for about worked on it for about, 2-3 years, and then I had retired from Coca-Cola Company, but I had started another career in corporate governance. I went on the board of directors of Chevron Corporation, the world's third largest oil company, Cummins, another global company, Cummins Engine. I went on the board of the PGA Tour. I just left the board of directors of Georgia Power Company, a Southern Company affiliate. And so corporate governance became my new career. I chaired the Executive Compensation Committee of the Chevron Corporation. I've always believed in being prepared, so I went back to school to learn executive compensation. I went to Stanford University for a crash course on executive compensation. When I was promoted to president of Coca-Cola Africa, I went to Harvard to study and got my degree in international senior management. When I was promoted to vice president of marketing for special markets for Coca-Cola, I went to Georgia State to work on my executive MBA at night and on Saturdays. So continuous learning, renewing your knowledge base is always absolutely essential, in my view, to stay ahead of the curve. It's not just about competing at a level. It's always leading out front. And that's what I always sought to do.
Now, what are you trying to help people accomplish or recognize with this body of work?
This work is, you know, I woke up one day and I looked at the city of Atlanta and realized that I had been a part of the politics, the events that have shaped this city. And Atlanta has been long known for its culture, its business, its civil rights, its politics. And so I realized that I needed to do something to put some of that down in writing. I also realized that I had been on the world stage. I had been working with renowned international global leaders who changed the course of world history. People like Desmond Tutu, Roberta Siguenza, who was my boss and my mentor at Coca-Cola Company. Worked closer to those people. So it was compelling for me to put it down on paper in this book, which I called Portrait of an American Businessman, One Generation from Cotton Field to Boardroom. And it is a book that says, regardless of your birth or where you come from, you can achieve and you can make a difference in your time on this earth. That's the story here. You can make a difference. You can take power. Business is a calling. It is not, to me, it was a calling, and still is. It's an opportunity to do good. The old saying that, you know, managers get paid to do things right. Leaders get paid to do the right thing. Mm. And that's what I always try to aspire to be, a leader, and to do it, to do the right thing, and at all times. I mean, there are no exceptions. That, you know, I look at why business is seen as a skeptical institution these days. Well, you know, you look at people in business who are leading major corporations who are just doing the wrong thing the wrong way. It's no wonder that we often find that when you go into a classroom, as I do with B students all the time, and they talk about a bit of skepticism about going to work for corporate in a corporate environment, because they see this ethical malaise or lack of ethics. I think we can do better. I say to corporate leaders, business executives, that in the case of diversity, it's not just the right thing to do, but it is a competitive advantage if you do it right.
Yeah.
It's a competitive advantage in terms of recruiting talented people. Young people coming out of these schools now, they want to go to work for a company that they can enjoy and be proud of and that they can talk about and live with and help develop and grow around. Is a competitive advantage with your customers. It's a way of distinguishing yourself. It's a point of differentiation.
Well, and you don't, or my observation is, you don't have to be a bigot to still have unconscious bias.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So to have a leadership team that has different lenses is genuinely a competitive advantage.
Roberta Gazueta, my mentor at Coke and my boss for a long time, once said in an executive committee meeting with us, he says that, you know, our management team, our employee base ought to fairly reflect our consumer base.
Mm-hmm.
If African Americans are 20% of our consumers.
That's foresight. That's smart.
Yeah, very foresight. That's all he said. And the management team got the message. Of course, I had it already, but you know, they got the message, and we sat about the job of creating a culture of diversity at Coca-Cola Company, and it worked and still works today. I'm very proud of the fact that number of women who I helped develop at Coca-Cola, Vicky Palmer, who became the CFO of Coca-Cola Enterprises, Ingrid Saunders-Jones, who became the chair of the Coca-Cola Foundation, and I was very proud to be the founder of the Coca-Cola Foundation, and brought her on as my mentee. Therese Thompson, who now heads supplier diversity, was my CFO in Africa, and she was my EA, and I mentored her into the job that she's doing in supplier development at Coca-Cola Company now. Kathy Waller, former CFO, just retired from the Coca-Cola Company, was on my staff, a part of my team. Alex Cummings, who I recruited from Pillsbury, he was a chief financial officer of Pillsbury International. I brought him into Coca-Cola Company. He's a Liberian-born African-American. And guess what? He succeeded me as president of Coca-Cola Africa.
Oh, nice.
So the job that you have is developing, not only making sure that you, when you get there, you use your power correctly, but use it for the benefit of others, in particular, whether it's customers, employees, or senior management, or the board of directors. As a board of, member of the board of directors of Chevron Corporation, I tried to set the tone again for insisting and understand and making sure that we understood our obligation as directors to ensure diversity, global diversity, not just U.S. base and style diversity.
Before we wrap, I apologize for, I mean, we could do this all day. It's such a compelling, inspiring story, and I love hearing your actual anecdotes and the foundation that that equipped you to actually live a life with that degree of principle-centered accomplishment. But before we wrap, and we do need to wrap this segment, one observation and maybe one or two other questions. An observation in the title of your book, it does not say Portrait of an African-American Businessman. Can you speak to that for a minute?
Yes. That was a deliberate, obviously,
thought maybe.
A deliberate thought. But I was once introduced. I was at a session out at McKenna College in California, and I was being introduced. And the person introducing me surprised me. He said, Carl Ware is an American success story. And I took that and I kept it sort of in the back of my head. And as I went about looking at, we must have examined 20 different titles. And we wanted to make sure that this is a story that resonates across racial, across ethnic, across international lines, and it's not just a story about an African American. I happen to be a proud African American, but this story is about an American businessman who took the opportunities and the came from a humble background, if you will, and took the opportunities that God gave him as a God would ordain it and as he lived it to do good. And to do the right thing and to make a great company even greater.
Well, given that, let's then address some counsel that might apply to virtually anyone coming from any situation. Me, I'm a number two guy in a small company that's, you know, it's a fun lifestyle kind of business, and we enjoy doing this and sharing these stories. To maybe someone who is, you know, next in line to run a multi-billion dollar company, what is some counsel that you might have to offer that would help each of us maybe get the most out of this book? Is there a lens through which we should look? Is there a way we should approach it? How would you encourage us to take full advantage of this body of work?
Well, first of all, I go buy it. That would be very helpful. It is a book about struggle. It's a book about leadership. And that's the message, really. Out of struggle, good leaders become stronger leaders. And throughout this book, I wrote it through the lens of great leaders like Desmond Tutu, like Nelson Mandela, like my mother and my father, and like Kudzweta. Even through the lens of Sheriff Lamar Potts, I wrote it through the lens of Miss Dorothy Mae Richardson, who was an encouraging figure in my graduate days at the University of Pittsburgh, who was a neighborhood activist who I learned so much about the use of grassroots power. And I wrote my book through the lens of others, my high school coach, you know, my college professors, my pastors, my mentors and mentees. Every story, over 35 of them in this book, has a message. And you can get it on Amazon.com, readily available. I think that's probably the quickest way to get a hold of the book. But of course, I partnered with Mercer University Press, and of course, you can get it through Mercer University Press. You can access me at CarlWareAuthor.com. And I formed my own publishing entity called Lucky Feather Media. Lucky Feather Media. .com you can also access the story there. So hopefully first and foremost it is a inspiration for you and for other executives and especially for young people, that you can, regardless of your where you come from, where you were born, you can achieve and you can make a difference in your time on this earth.
Well, I know it will be an inspiration. This conversation has certainly been an inspiration. One more time, let's leave them with the full title. I'll have you read it out for them.
Portrait of an American Businessman, One Generation from Cotton Field to Boardroom.
Fantastic. Well, Carl Ware, thank you so much for coming in today and sharing your story, man. And keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Managing Partner with Highland Oak Group, Ms. Nermeen Jasani. How are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I apologize that you have to follow that act.
No, it's very inspirational to hear everything that he has to say. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
No, it truly is. That was a lot of fun. But I know you're out there doing some great work for folks. Tell us a little bit, if you would, mission, purpose. What are you guys out there trying to do for folks?
So what Highland Oak Group is about is we are business consultants and we want to help companies grow. Specifically, we focus on doctors and lawyers, and that is our core group of clients, but we'll also work with other types of business owners. Specifically, what we really like working with is women business owners. 90% of my client base is women. And they are in all areas that you can imagine in business. I've got some lawyer clients, some doctor clients, of course, florists, restaurant owners. You know, women are really just everywhere in the business world these days. And it's so great to be able to offer them the support that they need to grow and actually become the kind of business that they always dreamed of being.
Okay, I want to share some anecdotal experience with you. I am on record more than once suggesting, and I do genuinely believe with this with all my heart, at least based on my experience, women are smarter, they're more collaborative, they're better with money, they're more comfortable in their own skin, mm-hmm. they're more coachable. This has been my personal experience.
Yes.
This is why I at least will give a quicker nod to a female who may want to open a new Business Radio X studio. Has this been your experience?
That women want to...
That they are all of the... I don't know. I just find them easier to work with.
They are.
I just like working with women.
They are. And what you said was so perfect, that women are more coachable. I think that is why I tend to work with women more. Yeah. I've had a lot of male clients come my way, and I usually kind of end up giving them the PETA rate, so they kind of go away, because I know that male clients, they are more difficult to work with. And it's not so much that it's the personality, but more so the expectation, right? Like, they have these grand expectations of being the next Coca-Cola without necessarily wanting to do the work that it takes to be the next Coca-Cola.
Or stick to those principles.
Exactly.
And some of us, like my mother, and Carl had was blessed with his mother. I mean, we had some great role models, and maybe some of us are more coachable than others. But anyway, so that's validating my experience. You do find that. Now, what compelled you to focus in on doctors, lawyers, professional
service areas?
Yeah.
So part of the reason is because I'm a lawyer myself. I practiced on Wall Street for a little bit. And so I understand the world of lawyers very well. And it's easy for me to sell my services to a lawyer being a lawyer. So I can sit here and say, hey, I get that you have deadlines to meet. And I get that you've got, you know, things that you need to accomplish and clients who are what I like to call vampire clients. And
wait a minute, I can't let that go. What describe a vampire client for us?
So it's basically a client that sucks all of the energy out of you without giving anything back to you.
Oh, I know her name. No, I'm teasing.
There's probably many names I'm sure that we can think of over here, but really a vampire client is a client who is taking up all of your time on your calendar. They're calling you constantly. They're asking for answers, but they're not doing what you tell them to do. And also, they're not paying. They're complaining about your rates, but they want to get what they want for free without giving anything back to you. And so those are what I call vampire clients.
Yeah,
and steer clear of them. Steer clear of them. If there's one thing that you're going to prepare for in 2020, it's to drop all your vampire clients.
Fire them. If you have them, fire them.
Fire them.
Got it. So what do you find the most rewarding? What do you enjoy the most about the work?
I enjoy working with all of my business owners who tell me, Nermeen, this is what I want from my business. This is what I've done to get here so far, and I haven't been able to get to this X point. So I'll give you a great example. I have a current client right now who is in the process of creating six different lines of business, and she's been thinking about these business ideas for since 2009 almost, and hasn't been able to execute on them. And they're all sort of coming out of what her central work is right now. So she's just a doctor, and she's got all these other business ideas, and I'm working with her to execute all of these really big picture, deeply impactful ideas in the business field that she's in. And that for me is one of the best things I can do. It's a thing that helps me wake up in the morning. And it's just so fantastic working with people who have these ideas and are willing to ask for help to make it happen. And that's a big thing when it comes to working with a lot of my clients, is they have to be willing to ask for help, and they have to be willing to say they don't know how to do something.
Now, doctors and lawyers, and my only real frame of reference for this is my brother-in-law, Howie. Howie is a dentist, and he's quite the craftsperson. He really takes the technical aspects of his job very seriously, spends a lot of time, money, energy in elevating his craft.
Yeah.
But one thing that Howie has done is he's really invested a great deal also in becoming a better business person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wonder, when you're coming out of dental school, when you're coming out of law school, when you're coming out of whatever you do to be like a MD,
mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of business training even now, right?
No, there's absolutely none. And I can tell you this is true for just about every area of whether it's medical practice or law practice or even chiropractic practice, whatever it might be. There is no class in the universities that's called how to run X type of business. Yes, you have marketing. Yes, you have advertising. Yes, you have social media management. You've got all these sort of subcategories of managing a business, but there's no big overarching class called how to run a business, how to run a law practice, how to run a dental practice, how to run a pediatric practice. That doesn't exist in business schools. And I am shocked that we are in approaching 2020 and these classes don't exist, when the number of doctors and lawyers who go through medical school and law school who end up having their own practice is probably close to 40 to 50%, because a lot of them may end up working with hospitals or larger firms. But guess what? In their late, it's usually around their mid to late 50s that they decide to leave either the hospital or the big law practice and start their own book of clients, mm-hmm. because they're getting ready for retirement, because they're tired of doing the hours, or maybe they've become empty nesters and they're ready to just work from home now. Whatever the situation is, it's always in that sort of late phase of life that they end up taking, you know, taking that step and taking that plunge into the business world. But there has been no class that offers them assistance on how to actually run a business. And what I find with a lot of my clients is even the most basic things they don't have. So me being a consultant, part of what I do is I connect them to the people that they need to be connected with. So a lot of my clients may not even have a CPA or a CPA that they like. So it's really great because I know a ton of CPAs, and I'll connect them to a CPA that's actually going to be a good fit for them and, you know, responds according to what their timeframes are and all that good stuff. And it's like the simplest of things that are often overlooked in the businesses. And, you know, I'll give you a great example. A lot of my clients, I'll ask them, how'd you come up with your pricing? Why are you charging this? Whether it's a doctor or a lawyer, why are you charging $300 an hour? Why are you charging, you know, let's say $1,000 for a root canal? What is the purpose of this pricing? They usually look at me and they say, well, the guy across the street charges, you know, $350, so I decided to charge $300. And I almost want to pull my hair out when they say this, because I'm like, this is insane. You're basing your entire price structure, how much you make every year, on what the guy across the street from you charges. It's absurd to me. And every time I have to sit down with my clients, you know, we go through an entire pricing formula and I help them understand, you know, one, please get away from hourly pricing. It's going to kill you. Also, two, when you do charge your rates, make sure that you're including your years of experience. What mm-hmm. makes you different from the competition? You can actually add those quote unquote intangibles into how you price your services.
So in your mind, it's not purely a time and materials equation.
No.
Even for, I mean, I guess I always sort of figured that for a marketing consultant mm-hmm. or something like that, but even for a doctor lawyer, it's more than time and materials.
Oh, absolutely. So I'll give you some examples, right? So let's take a dentist, right? I had a root canal done earlier this year, and I don't know if you know the pain you feel before you go through a root canal, but I would have pretty much given my right arm to like not have that pain anymore. So when I think about it that way, what are you actually supplying to the client? You're providing them no more pain. You're providing them sleep through the night. And for someone who is busy and high achieving like myself, I will do anything to be able to be focused and not be thinking about the mouth pain, mm-hmm. right? So I would have paid $3,000 to see someone the very next hour to help me get rid of this pain. So I say that to say, you know, there's intangibles, there's a value add that you provide as a business owner to your clients, and you have to take that into account when you are figuring out your prices. It's not just, it costs me, you know, $2 to make the bottle and, you know, $1 for the ingredients in the bottle. So I'll sell it for $3, but, you know, I'll charge $4.50 because, you know, that sounds good. You know, it's got to be a little bit more than that.
But that's more prevalent than I think we would like to admit, right? That sort of logic that you just laid out. Okay. So walk us through the early parts of an engagement.
Yeah.
We've got a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer out there. What happens first? You come out and we just sit down and we chat for a little bit, or we go down the Jasmine?
So there's a couple of things that I do before I even take on a client. And part of it has to be that you and I have to have a good working relationship. If we can't sit here and laugh about stuff and it's just going to be a very serious conversation and you're not going to be able to smile or laugh,
not your jam,
then it's not going to work. And okay. You probably will never hear from me again. So really, once I agree to take on a client, what happens is I come in and we do a business assessment. And that business assessment is what I like to call similar to what you do with a personal trainer the first time you work out with them. They make you do push-ups. They make you do squats. They try to see what you can do and how much you can do and how terrible you look doing it. That's exactly what the business assessment is.
Because in my mind, I'm 15 and I'm, you know, playing baseball at Pine Forest, right?
Exactly.
I'm in the tip-top shape, but that's
exactly.
not reality.
It's not really what's happening, right? And so what's so great about this business assessment is we go through each and every area of your business. There's what I like to call 8 business departments. So we'll go through each one of them, and then it will highlight what is your weakest area of business. And that tells me what I need to focus on. So basically how I run my engagements is they're all 3 months to start, because 3 months is really the trial period to see how we're getting along. Because I have to know that if I tell you to do something, you're going to do it, and you're not just going to sit on it until the end and then say, well, you know, I thought you were going to help me grow my business. Nothing's happened. You know, you have to do the work too. And so, you know, when we work together for 3 months, we start out with making sure the fundamentals of your business are in place. So what I call the fundamentals of your business are, like I mentioned earlier, your pricing. We also got to have a budget for you, because, you know, we're not Coca-Cola. We're not Apple, right? You don't have millions of dollars to spend on marketing campaigns, mm-hmm. right? You've got a very realistic budget.
You got to be
budget.
Smart with that money, right?
Exactly. And we've got to use that money where it is best spent, right? And what's going to give you the greatest return on it. And it could be hiring an admin who takes off, you know, 20 hours of work from your plate, and now you can go and bring on new clients.
All right, you just sent chills up my spine. Again, I'm number two guy. We got a good little thing going here.
Yeah.
And it's starting to grow. But I got to tell you, it's truly a fear. I got to learn from Carl how to work through my fear. Bringing on another person.
Mm-hmm.
And not just the money. There's the money, there's the time, there's the effort. And if it doesn't work out, and I mean,
yeah,
you gotta be part therapist, right? And help people like me get over that.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It is. So I actually have a client who, when I go see him, he's usually like, okay, so we need 20 minutes of therapy time. I need you to walk me through this. And so I'm happy to wear that hat for my clients as well. You know, coach/therapist. It's not just consultant and looking at your numbers. It's also making sure that you're mentally prepared to be where you need to be in your business. But when it comes to bringing someone on to support you, whether it's an ad, admin, a virtual admin, whatever it looks like, there's a couple things to consider. One is you got to look at the value of your time versus what it's going to cost this person, right? So the value of your time is probably a lot more than, let's say, a $15 an hour admin, right? So if you were able to even allot off 5 hours of work each week, that's, you know, very minimal, cost wise, you know, it's $100, less than that. What can you do then with that extra 5 hours? Probably a lot.
A ton. And I'll bet you he or she is going to be so much more effective and efficient at whatever I have that person do for those 5 hours. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense.
Exactly. And so that's the thing that a lot of business owners have to think about is you got to put it into numbers. And that's why I always say numbers don't lie. So when I sit down and I talk with my clients about business strategy and what's next and where to go, I always do it based on the numbers. It's never based on, oh, well, my gut tells me this, or I feel like everything I do is backed up by the numbers and what the market says and what the audience says and what the ideal client says, right? And so here for you, you've got to look at the numbers as well, which is how much value can you get by not doing this tedious work for 5 hours, right?
So do you know, and I think I know the answer to this, do you know pretty early on if you're going to be able to, A, help this person at all, B, help them a little or help them a lot, just by the way they carry themselves and sort of respond to the conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the benefit of having been a lawyer is I happen to be very intuitive, and I can tell when people are going to BS me and when they're being, you know, genuinely honest about where they want to go in their business. And so that's easy to pick up on in the first hour of a meeting. Very easy.
You can just jump right on it, and then you know what, and then you can make some decisions about if and how to proceed.
Exactly, exactly. And we sort of go through a roadmap of what the client wants to accomplish. And it's always, look, I've never worked with a business owner who says, no, I don't want to make more money, right? Like, have you ever met that business owner?
No, I have not.
I've never either. And so it's always sort of going in with the assumption of they want to make more money, and I am here to help them make more money. That is my job, that is my purpose in working with them. And whether it's through creating a budget for them or looking at their pricing or getting together an advertising strategy that actually works for them, it's all to make more money.
All right. So not unlike the image that you painted of the root canal and get rid of the pain. It's not pay me for my time and my craft of fixing the tooth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to come in and help you turn the right dials so that you can make more money.
Absolutely.
All right. So before we wrap, tell us a little bit about what's in front of you. What are your plans in the coming months?
I would love to tell you about what's in front of me. So as of last week, I also published a book. It's called How to Be Type A Without Being an A-Hole. So that is literally the title of the book. And it's because I work with mostly doctors and lawyers, and I happen to be type A myself, and they also happen to be type A personalities, that I've created this book. It's a 60-page book of how to not make everyone around you go crazy, and just to sort of be seen while being hyper achieving, hyper goal oriented, hyper pedigree focused, right? So
what an exciting time for you. So it's written, it's out on the market.
It's available on Amazon. How to Be Type A Without Being an A-Hole.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So before we wrap, what is happening in my world? Flags, signals that I can see around me that say, you know what, maybe I should reach out, at least have a conversation.
Yeah. So the reality is we're approaching 2020, and there's been a lot of news in the world about a pending recession, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's something that's going to happen in the market, especially if you're in real estate. You might have seen, you know, things kind of slow down a little bit for you this year. That's usually where you start to first see the signs, is in real estate. Home Depot has reported some not as great numbers as they expect it to be. That's another indication of, you know, sort of an upcoming recession. So what I want to say is this. 2020 is coming up. If there is a recession, pause and ask yourself, are you ready for it? is your business ready for it? Are you looking at your financial projections like it's, you know, 2005 and everything is amazing and the world is, you know, the sky is blue and everything is great? Or are you looking at it like, hey, let's be a little bit realistic and let's actually say, let's create a projection of a what if. What if there is a recession and I'm only bringing in half of what I brought in last year?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to be able to make it? Or am I going to have to consider bankruptcy? Or am I going to be pulling my hair out? Or am I going to be borrowing money from my parents? Whatever the situation is.
These are some very sobering adult questions, right? But you're suggesting
exactly.
That we have the responsibility to ask those.
Yeah, be honest with yourself. Especially if you employ other people, it's your responsibility to stop and pause and say, am I going to be able to keep these people on next year if the numbers are not what I think that they're going to be? Because you have the responsibility as an employer to make sure that you can keep them on because they're relying on you just like you're relying on them.
And if I don't have great answers to those questions, I should at least reach out and have a conversation with Nermeen.
Absolutely.
Or somebody on your team.
Yeah,
right?
Reach out to me. I'm more than happy to speak to anyone. It doesn't cost anything to ask questions.
Right.
You know, so call me, email me, ask me questions. I'm here to help, really.
All right. So let's leave our listeners with some coordinates. Best way to get our hands on this book and to have a conversation with you or someone on your team, whatever you feel like is appropriate, LinkedIn, email, website, whatever.
Sure. Okay. So best way to get to the book is going to be on Amazon. Just type in the search bar, how to be type A without being an a-hole, how to reach out to me.
Title.
How to reach out to me is going to be my email address. It's going to be the best way to reach me. It's Nermeen, N-E-R-M-I-N, at Highland, H-I-G-H-L-A-N-D, Oak, O-A-K, group.com.
Marvelous. Well, thank you so much
sharing
your
story. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with a couple more guests.
We'll do.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us from Eminence Physical Therapy and Champions Can Foundation for Cancer Wellness, Dr. Crystal Champion. Hello there.
Hello.
So before we get started, what did you learn in those last two segments? I thought I saw you nodding your head, taking a few notes.
Absolutely. I said, these are two people I really need to make sure I get to know.
So tell us a little bit about your practice and how you're trying to help people.
So I'm the owner of Eminence Physical Therapy, and I'm a physical therapist by trade, and currently I specialize in cancer rehabilitation and lymphedema treatment. And a lot of people usually don't know what lymphedema is, but lymphedema is a condition that is characterized by chronic swelling of an extremity of the body, and is usually a result of a secondary cause. So, for example, a lot of people are familiar with lymphedema as for someone who's gone through a cancer diagnosis, they've had cancer treatment. So someone has had surgery, lymph node removal as a result of cancer, or they've had chemotherapy, radiation. Those things can cause lymphedema, or what's known as secondary lymphedema. It can also be caused as a result of trauma or different other surgeries. And there's also something called primary lymphedema, which a person is born with an impairment of their lymph system in the body. And so when the fluid can't circulate the way that it needs to, it often results in a backup of fluid, and then the extremity starts to swell.
That cannot be good for you.
It's not good.
I'm no doctor, but that cannot be good for you.
It's not good.
So how do you address that with your practice? Because are there gizmos? Are there things you can do at home, I'm sure, but how do you address it with your work?
Absolutely. So the gold standard of treatment for lymphedema is called complete decongestive therapy. And so that involves four things. And so the first thing would be manual lymph drainage, which I use my hands. It's a very light superficial massage to help reroute that fluid out of the backed up extremity. And then in order to keep that fluid out of the area once it's been moved, we also have to do compression. So there's different types of compression garments that can be utilized. There's compression bandaging. And then once the compression has been applied, we do exercises, or what we call decongestive exercises, to further help use the muscles in the body to help pump that fluid out of the swollen arm or the leg. And it's not like you have to run a marathon or anything for these exercises. Very simple things like raising your arm, kicking your leg, pumping your fist. Those are very simple things. And then we also are very meticulous about skin care and nail care, because if there's opportunity for bacteria to enter your skin because you have a cut or a wound or an abrasion, that can introduce infection, and it can exacerbate the symptoms of lymphedema, which I can go over as well.
Well, this the compression thing, that strikes me as something that you ought to have a professional show you how to do that right, even though I recognize you can do it at home. Maybe you can, But you could, if you get that wrong, you're going to cause problems, right?
Exactly. Is that true? It's highly specialized. So there are not a lot of lymphedema therapists around. So it's truly indeed an area of specialty. And compression has to be applied in the right way, whether you're looking at bandages or garments, because if it's ill-fitted compression, it can definitely worsen the symptoms of lymphedema. And some of the symptoms include usually visible swelling is usually a sign, heaviness in the arm or the leg. Sometimes there's loss of function. So someone may have difficulty bathing themselves, dressing themselves. They may have trouble walking, getting up and down from a chair. Skin changes. A lot of times the swelling that's associated with lymphedema, it has protein in the fluid, and protein, once it's sitting in the tissues for a while, can lead to skin changes, which we call fibrosis, which is a hardening and thickening of the skin. Mm-hmm. And once it's progressed to that point, lymphedema can be a little more difficult to treat. It's treatable in any stage, but it's more difficult to treat once those skin changes have set in.
Okay, so like most things, early is better, right?
Early, definitely early is better. And I'm a big proponent of, you know, especially patients that have gone through cancer treatment and cancer diagnoses, you know, definitely get to a physical therapist or a lymphedema therapist, even if you know you're going to have those treatments, go ahead of time and get a pre-treatment evaluation. And then, you know, maybe 6 to 8 weeks after you're complete with that treatment or that surgery, go back to that therapist and have a post-operative assessment so we can easily identify, you know, the onset of lymphedema.
Okay. So what's the downside? And I'm thinking maybe there is no downside. I'm 56. I'm kind of due for my 90,000 mile checkup, right? Mm-hmm. There's probably a lot of stuff that, and I'm not like maybe a lot of guys. I don't remember the last time I went to a doctor. Mm-hmm. Is there any downside, or does it make sense to sort of build into, yep, go see the dentist, see, get on top of that, go to a physical therapist and just kind of do a, I don't even know what you'd call it, a general assessment? Is it?
Yes. I always say your body is the biggest indicator of something's not right. If something doesn't look right, if something doesn't feel right, pain is often an alarm signal. So, you know, if you have pain or swelling and you're not sure of what the cause is, speak with your primary care doctor and say, hey, I want to have this evaluated, whether it's by a vascular specialist. If it's a cancer patient, mention it to your oncologist and the people that are part of your care team. And then also, I'm a big proponent of people being advocates for themselves. If you know there's something not right, be persistent with your medical team until you can get to the bottom of what's going on and until you can get to the right professional that can address it. Because not everyone can recognize what lymphedema is. It really is a specialty, and it takes a trained eye to be able to diagnose it and to recognize exactly what it is so it can be properly treated.
Okay. So you're clearly a dedicated practitioner. You have specialized knowledge, expertise, and I'm sure some very strong opinions about a variety of things related to that craft. Tell us about the business side of what you're doing, because you're running your own shop here.
Yes.
You chose, I guess, at least at this stage in your life, not to go work for, you know, the big corporate thing. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
So I did. I worked for a major hospital system here in the Atlanta area for about 10 years.
Oh, okay.
And in that, I actually had the chance to become trained as a lymphedema therapist and to start the lymphedema treatment program there. And in that, I just felt like my hands were tied on a lot of things that I really wanted to do to be able to fully, what I say, expand my wings and help people in a way that wasn't dictated by insurance or wasn't dictated by this rule, this policy, this procedure. When you're working with clients that have a chronic illness, they require a lot of attention and one-on-one time. And as a physical therapist, we often spend the most amount of time with patients, more so than, you know, their nurses or their doctors. For example, my treatments are 60 to 90 minutes. That's a lot of time to be able to spend with a client and to be able to get to know them, you know, their psychological state, their mental state, their emotional state, and most importantly, their physical state. So in that, I saw the need to branch out and start my own practice so I could be able to do those things openly and freely. And also along that line, it allowed me to serve cancer patients on a larger scale and where I saw that there were needs in the community that were lacking. And so that also led me to found Champions Can Foundation for Cancer Wellness Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization that advocates for cancer survivorship, regardless of the cancer diagnosis. So my biggest thing is that cancer survivorship begins at the time of diagnosis. And so my organization strives to be a support to those people before, during, and after. that care. You know, I have a lot of people come to me and they get on the table and they say, you know, Dr. Champion, now that my cancer treatment is done, I'm left with lymphedema. I can't function. I have this cancer-related treatment fatigue. Now that I've gone through chemotherapy and surgery and radiation, I have to get back to work. I have a family to support. I have children to feed. Or, you know, I feel like I have post-traumatic stress disorder from going through a cancer diagnosis and going to those numerous appointments and laying in those, you know, MRI machines countless amount of times. And, you know, some people say, well, hey, that's just a part of the cancer treatment. You have to deal with it. And I said, no, that's not necessarily the case. Cancer survivorship begins at diagnosis, which means, you know, we're at a point of trying to get you physically restored, psychologically restored, spiritually restored. And I found that that was lacking with a lot of the patients that I was seeing.
So this freed you up. Becoming an entrepreneur, setting up your own practice freed you up to do the right thing the right way, as our friend Carl would say.
Absolutely. Gave me that flexibility to be able to focus in on that area. So they kind of go hand in hand. I feel that what I do, you know, like Mr. Weir over here, is a ministry and it's purposeful. And that's what I strive to do with Eminence Physical Therapy in addition to Champions Can Foundation.
Wow. So the sales and marketing aspect of what you do you find that the phone rings, or do you have to somehow, some way get out there and shake the bushes a little bit?
I definitely have to shake the bushes and the leaves and the branches and everything that comes along with it. Because even my structure in terms of my therapy practice is a little bit different. I don't accept insurance right now just because insurance has changed the way that they reimburse for lymphedema services and outpatient physical therapy services altogether. And it puts a lot of limitations and caps on how people can be treated and how many visits that they need. And as I said, when you're dealing with cancer and lymphedema, a lot of times you have ailments and side effects from that can be chronic and that can be long term. And a lot of these insurance companies don't want to reimburse for chronic conditions and long term illnesses that these clients need. So my structure right now allows the freedom and the flexibility for people to come and get treatment when they need.
All right, let's don't end the streak now. We're 2 for 2 so far. You have a book.
I do have a book. I do have a book. So the book is called The Elements of Cancer Survivorship, A Guide to Navigating the Journey. And it was co-authored by myself in addition to one of my former clients, as well as the vice president of my foundation. Her name is Marcia Dupree, and she's actually a breast cancer survivor. And so in treating her, you know, as a therapist and working alongside her, she said, you know, Dr. Champion, there are so many questions or things I wish I'd known when I went through my journey. And I just want to be able to help people understand the ins and outs of what needs to be done when you're navigating a healthcare journey. For example, financial considerations. You know, a lot of people don't think about that. Some people file bankruptcy and all sorts of things because they're in a financial strain because of all the co-pays and out-of-pockets and deductibles that they have to meet in order just to get treatment. Also just, you know, your diagnosis in general. So you hear the word cancer, people automatically, you know, think it's a death sentence, and it's not. That's why I'm so passionate about survivorship. But you need to know, okay, what are the treatments for my particular type of cancer? What clinical trials are out there? If I don't get this treatment that you're recommending, what are my other options? Can I have a second opinion? Can I have a third opinion? Can I have a fourth opinion? What if something happens and I cannot get to my treatments because of transportation issues? Those are all valid things that people need to consider. What's my insurance? What's my co-pays? What's my deductible? Is this specialist that I want to go to, for example, prostate cancer, is he in my network for my insurance to be able to cover who I really want to go and give me treatment? So there are a lot of ins and outs that go with a cancer diagnosis. You know, mine is going through the actual healthcare system. You have to think about all of those elements as well.
And so this book addresses
it? It does. So it's basically a guide that you can take into the doctor's office with you. And there's actually a checklist of questions that you can ask and that I highly recommend that people ask. You know, what other medical professionals, you know, in addition to my medical oncologist, am I going to encounter? Am I going to see a physical therapist?
Right.
Am I going to see a mental health counselor to help me deal with the psychological stress that can be associated with the cancer diagnosis? So all of those things are definitely highly recommended that you ask and that you know. Or sometimes, you know, when you hear the word cancer, that's all you hear. And so when someone's explaining that process to you, you don't hear anything else. So to have that guide or to have a family member or a friend accompany and support you, and that can also have that frame of reference, really helps to ease some of that burden that can be associated when you hear that cancer diagnosis for the first time. So it's just, you know, like I said, I encourage people to be advocates, and part of being an advocate is knowing and researching and knowing what it is and how your body is going to be affected.
Okay, one more time, the name of this book?
It's called The Elements of Cancer Survivorship, A Guide to Navigating the Journey, and it is available on Amazon.
And the best way for someone to learn more about your practice or talk with you or somebody on your team, what's the best coordinates for that?
It's www.eminencept.com. And for Champions Can, it's www.championscanfoundation.org. And both are also on Facebook and Instagram as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, stay with us. We got one more guest we're going to visit with. All right. Y'all ready for the headliner? She's been very patient through all of these segments, but we're delighted to have her with us. We have with us the president and CEO of Georgia Center for Nonprofits. She's also the Grand Poobah Chief Cook and Bottle Washer for Georgia Gives Day, I think. Please join me in welcoming to the show Miss Karen Beaver. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming and joining us. Have you enjoyed the conversation as much as I have? Have you learned anything?
I really have. And I tell you, it's funny, working in the nonprofit sector my whole career, I'm drawing parallels between what Nermeen does and what we do. And of course, Carl Ware, and you know, I worked very closely with Ingrid Saunders Jones and now Helen Price, and just love both of those. And I know his influence on both of their lives. They talked about him all the time. And then Dr. Champion, your nonprofit, and I know all about, you know, how hard it is to start that, and really respect the fact that you're doing that with a full time job as well. So kind of have connections to all these.
You got a good crew
folks
here this morning,
really,
don't we?
Really, really do.
All right, so Georgia Center for Nonprofits, could you just give us all a little bit of a primer, just an overview of that entity, mission, purpose, that kind of
thing? Sure. Well, our mission is pretty straightforward. We help nonprofits succeed through better management, leadership, and governance. And so we really feel like when nonprofits succeed, communities thrive. It takes a village, as they say, and, you know, it's business, government, and nonprofits all working together to make a community thrive and make our quality of life great.
Now, you've been at this a while. This is not your first rodeo.
I have. I always say lotions, potions, and hair color, right? We'll get you through everything. So it's been 24 years.
Well, the reason I ask, someone of your drive, your talent, your poise, I'm sure you had a great many choices. I'm sure you've had additional choices throughout your career. But you've really decided to stay the course with this path, and I'd love to hear more about how and why.
I have. You know, I think part of it is that the nonprofit sector is so interesting. It's not one thing. It's health, it's education, it's arts, it's culture, it's environment. It's people that are passionate working on things that, you know, are their life's work, their life's passion. You never work with a jerk. I can really say that, to be honest with you. I've never had to work with a jerk. So it's really fascinating to see all the different kinds of personalities that have this passion for a particular cause, whether that's as a board member or as a volunteer or as a staff member, and they're putting their heart and soul into it. And I feel very fortunate to be able to help them every day do what they do better, you know, put that soul, they put the soul into community, and we're happy to put the business into their soul, right? So that's, you know, we bring that business side of their passion to bear on making a bigger impact on community.
I want to ask you about, I don't know what the right word is, a phenomenon, a barrier, a dynamic, but this is something I have personally experienced, and I think I'm sort of working my way through. I think there have been times when I've envisioned participating in sort of some sort of philanthropic effort, being part of a cause was just too big, too hairy. You know, I'll do that next year when my business is in better shape or my net worth's back. And the truth of the matter is, when I hear you guys talk and I hear Carl talk about taking a few leftover vegetables and sharing them with people who could, we don't have to bite off this big, huge thing to really genuinely serve, do we?
Not at all. You know, I just say half the battle is just recognizing yourself as an everyday philanthropist. You don't have to have millions of dollars to be helpful, right? It's the kindnesses every day in your office space. You know, it is the generosity of your time, your talent, your treasure, as they say. You know, Georgia Gives Day is a big example of that. I know we haven't talked about that very much, but it was on December 3rd and Giving Tuesday. A lot of people are familiar with that, but we run Georgia Gives Day on Giving Tuesday, which we are trying to make the largest single day of generosity in the state of Georgia. And you can really just give a little or a lot. It doesn't take a lot. You can be an everyday philanthropist. You don't have to be Bill Gates. It all accrues up because it's actually what I do, plus what you do, plus what Carl does, plus what Nermeen does, plus what Dr. Champion does every day that makes makes community work. And so and I always say, we live in the South, and in the South, you don't invite yourself to somebody else's wedding, right? And there's sort of this persona among nonprofits that you somehow have to be invited in, but that's actually not true. The needs are great, and it really just takes a passion and interest, and I promise you, you will never be turned down if you want to help. Where there is a need, there is a nonprofit, and there's always a need for everyone inside a nonprofit to volunteer, to help, to give a little bit of their time.
So the impetus and the frame for Georgia Gives specifically, talk a little bit more about that, how that got started and what that's about.
It's really weird to talk about right now because crowdfunding is so ubiquitous. You see it all around. But when we started this back in 2012, it was as an idea that started because of the Great Recession, and it was infecting so many nonprofits, and they were struggling. The demand was off the charts huge. If you think about all of the different people that lost their jobs, and they were, you know, grappling with, you know, you name it, nonprofits were stepping up, and we wanted to be able to help them find new donors and to activate donors to understand what was going on and to give. And what Georgia Gives Day is, at the bottom of the day, is it is a very large media campaign to get out the word about the work and the worth of nonprofits and to help people, just encourage them to give just a little bit. And by that, I mean like literally $5, right? And so in 6 months' time, we recruited roughly about 2,000 nonprofits. We built an entire website, a crowdfunding website, and amassed a lot of media partners and held our first Gives Day. And it's grown from there, and we've raised well over well, as of last year, $28 million. So this year it'll be about $8 million more. So that'll be about $34 million in about six singular days of giving. So it's amazing. People are very generous. And when they're asked, and that's the first rule of fundraising, ask, they will generally step up.
So you spoke earlier in the conversation about bringing different I don't know what walks of life together, government, business. Tell me a little bit, 'cause I get the sense that you guys have sort of mastered the art of connecting everyone and giving them some vehicle for focus and energy. And
right. Well, I think a good example, again, might be Georgia Gives Day, and I'll pick on the Coca-Cola company because Mr. Ware's here, but also because they're just such a champion of community. And as many of you out there listeners know, they're about women, wellness, and water. And so we approached the foundation around helping to spur giving for women's empowerment, which is what the Coca-Cola Foundation is all about. They put up last year $100,000 to incentivize giving, and this year $250,000 to match giving. And we matched that over, it was about 2.5 to 1. So for every dollar that the Coca-Cola Foundation put up for these entities, the public put up another $2.5, and that translates into a lot of amazing work. And I'll give you a little story. There's a group out of Clarkston called Just Bakery, and it's refugee women that come into this country, and they're from Somalia. They're from many places that they're fleeing, and they make incredible baked goods, and they're empowering these women to learn how to start and run a business. They're now selling. They'll deliver baked goods to your front door. And they're amazing. And so last year, we found them and put them in this this initiative with the Coca-Cola Foundation. And they raised $6,000. And this year, they doubled that. And they'll get a match accordingly. And so these things make a big difference. And that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but that is a lot of money. That is a lot of money for this particular organization. And there are many, many more, obviously, that we work with that do that kind of work. But that, to your question, shows the power of a full community coming together. It cannot just be nonprofits. It cannot just be companies. It cannot just be the government. We all have to work together. These are big, big issues, and it really takes a team and a diverse team, as Mr. Weir talked about, that see these issues from the ground up and from the top down, and we all come together around big solutions that make a bigger impact at the end of the day on these problems. And empower people to use their passions and their, as I said, their talent, their treasure, you know, their time for the highest and best purpose that they can. And we're proud to be an entity that empowers that to happen on all sides of the equation.
It must be incredibly rewarding work. Talk to us a little bit about a day in the life of you. Are you out there visiting? Because, I mean, Coca-Cola has set a marvelous example, but Mercedes-Benz gets behind this Gas South, Fifth Third Bank.
Inspire are brands. These, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So are you out sort of having these conversations? And my, well, let me validate this. My suspicion is you're not convincing them to do it as much as you're helping them get the most out of what they want to do already.
That's right. You know, one of the things I'm proudest about being in Atlanta, I'm a native Atlanta, and I always tell people they can touch me because I think I'm one of seven people that actually grew up here. Carl and I will have a conversation later on about how Atlanta's changed. But I'm proud to be an Atlantan because we have wonderful companies here that really step up and they want to do the right thing and they have really fantastic programs. They're looking for an outlet just like you and I are, right? And they're mm-hmm. wanting to focus. They have a business objective around that. It has to be consistent with their mission and their business. But I'm telling you, companies are really about the people inside the companies. And if you know anything about it, you meet
yes.
folks, and it's really,
well
it's
said.
Just me and you talking about what we're interested in at the end of the day, whether you're president of that company or whether you're their marketing person or, you know, person on the street. And people want to do the right thing. They're looking for outlets, and they just need to be maybe nudged a little bit or asked or just shown the way, shown that opportunity. And I've seen amazing things happen when you just present an opportunity for a company, a person to get involved. But yeah, I am pretty passionate about this work. I'm out in the community all the time. So if you're around me at any point pumping gas or, you know, at a cocktail party or wherever I'm at, I'm going to be talking about, what nonprofits do and why they make a difference in community. But also, I want to tell you, they make a difference in your life. I always say you live your life in nonprofits. You just don't know it. You could have graduated from a nonprofit, you know, college or university. Maybe your kid goes to a nonprofit daycare, could have adopted your dog from a nonprofit, you know, rescue. You can literally be born in a nonprofit hospital, die in a nonprofit hospice. So you're, the arc of your life, walking on the path, you know, just the safety cones in the middle of those crosswalks in Atlanta are due to a nonprofit putting those there. So it's an amazing fabric of your everyday life. And I want people to appreciate that and to support support the industry as a whole as very critical to not only your quality of life, but our democracy and our community. And then I want people to be able to just reflect and just say, how's this touched me? What can I get involved in? And open their heart to a little bit of time, a little bit of treasure, a little bit of your talent. Your skills will go a long way to helping people, whether it's cancer diagnosis or whether it's, you know, helping small business or helping women entrepreneurs, you know, do better or, you know, whatever turns you on, right?
So if you're a registered nonprofit in Georgia, that's sort of your ticket to play in this arena, right? Is that about the
that's
only
right.
real criteria?
Yeah, that is it. You know, if you're a 501c3, you know, we want to talk to you. We do have some resources for folks that are thinking of starting nonprofits, a startup guide. That's not really our thing. We don't start them up, but we can point you to some resources. But we're really about those organizations that are, you know, functioning, and we're trying to get them to the next level of impact. And so I always say, you know, better management, leadership, and governance can help organizations teach those five, you know, Johnnies learn to read better, another mile a path, you know, some more water conserved. It really makes a big impact when it all accrues up.
All right. So we're right on the backside of the most recent Georgia Gives Day. Did I get that?
We are. And, you know, we're still waiting on final totals because, you know, now, as I said, crowdfunding was so specific back in 2012, but now you can get through Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and everywhere else. So we're waiting for the totals. We think it'll be over $8 million. We raised just on our one little platform about $3.3 million in that one period of time, and then we'll total up for the other platforms, and it'll probably be a little over $8 million
all right,
this year.
So a quick latte, a couple of media appearances, and then you can't rest on your laurels. So what's next? You're back at it, right?
One gives day stops and another one starts, right?
Right.
So, the giving goes on. And so we're really in the giving season right now. Mm-hmm. And what I want to tell people is that you can still go to gagivesday.org. And you can put in a few keywords. You can put in dog, and you'll find rescue services, but also guide dogs for the blind and canine assistance and many, many organizations. You can put in your zip code and find all local organizations around you. And so if you didn't get a chance to give on December 3rd, that is not over right now. You can certainly go ahead and find an organization that you care about and do that end of the year giving. And we encourage you to do that. So you can be part of the giving goes on right now.
I love it. I was going to ask that question as we wrap, what can we be doing to help? And it sounds like there's a very immediate answer. And then there's opportunity all year long to capitalize on this. Yeah,
there really is. You know, where there's a need, there's a nonprofit, as I said. And so everybody's got something that they can are passionate about. And, you know, you can use the Georgia Gives Day platform just to find a nonprofit. So we would encourage you to go on. There are over 2,000 registered nonprofits on that. Actually, we have every nonprofit in the state of Georgia listed on there. So you go ahead and put your zip code in or a keyword. Again, cancer, you'll come up with so many different organizations, and you can research those. It's attached to GuideStar. You can look at their 990s and things like that, find their volunteer opportunities. And there are many organizations in Atlanta, like Hands on Atlanta. There's another online group called Volunteer Match. Feel free to go ahead and Google those, and you can find volunteer opportunities that that appeal to your purpose, and get involved. Again, we're gcn.org, Georgia Center for Nonprofits.org. If you're on a board out there or running a nonprofit and you need a little help with your business side of what you do, feel free to hit our website. We've got consultants and trainers and all kinds of good resources just at your beck and call for you. And then go to gagives.org, give a little or a lot to a cause you care about.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show. Thank you so much for getting us caught up.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right. And thank you all for coming in and sharing your story. This has been a marvelous experience for me, and I know it has for our listeners. We will see you next time on Atlanta Business Radio.